afternoon, everybody, and we can start KP as well. My name is Banda Dysalt. I am originally from Brazil, and I am currently teaching at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. We will be talking this afternoon about a very complex, very complicated notion, which is how suffering, resilience, and hope interconnect. Many of my students, when I address a topic like this or an issue that is so entangled, they will use the word, oh, but this is too complicated. And I love the word complicated. Complicated comes from the Latin, which means cum plexus. Cum plexus means that it has, cum plexus means with foldings. So anything that is complicated is has many foldings, and then what you do by addressing it is to show how a particular issue actually unfolds. Okay? So let's address something that's very complicated and try to find meaning in how these three, suffering, resilience, and hope, are actually interconnected. If nothing else, you learned a little bit of Latin this afternoon. Right, so you already learned your day. I have two handouts for you. And the reason why I have these handouts is that I obviously speak with an accent. Acoustics is not always my best friend. And you will have something to go back and remember our conversations by, even if you are not taking notes at this point. We will not be reading everything that's written here. There are additional references to books and other resources that you can also draw from. The reason why I got engaged in this very notion of embodiment and how it relates to suffering, I had breast cancer 2 years ago. And although it was a very, it was detected very early, it was stage one, it was the best case scenario, one of the side effects of radiation and surgery was lymphedema. And lymphedema means that you have a problem which can lead to chronic pain. And that is one of the side effects that I carry. And so I was trying to find meaning also in pain and how it relates to a theological meaning. So that's where I'm coming from, and I think it relates to other issues as well. I want to start with two quotes from this handout on When My Body Abandons Me. The first one comes from Proust, and the second one comes from Freud. And Proust says, "To kindness, to knowledge, we only make promises, but to pain, we obey." And from Freud, "The way in which we gain knowledge of organs during painful illnesses is perhaps a model of the way we in general arrive at the idea of the body." And the second quote by Freud is actually, it was a very important moment of awareness for me, that the majority of people do not have a real attachment to their bodies. They do not feel themselves as embodied beings. Because we only notice our bodies when something is not well, right? We only pay attention. We only obey when something is hurting. And because of that, when the body is functioning perfectly, it is unnoticeable. If a society is functioning perfectly, it's unnoticeable. If a community functions perfectly, it is unnoticeable. But because perfection does not exist, we have to be paying constant attention to it. So our body disappears to a great extent of our lives because it is not calling our attention. And for us, because for us, especially in the Western society, the body is like a machine which we ask to perform, and upon that command, it is supposed to perform. So we treat it as a machine. And as a machine, when it gets old, one of its parts is not working properly, we just treat it as such. We have to bring it in for repairs. And I love the language, you know, of heart surgery or implants. It's like, yeah, you know, you have to have a hip replacement, a knee replacement, and then you're ready to go again. And death for us in the Western Hemisphere is just the cessation of all sensation. When we start, we stop just being able to feel, and feel also our own pain. Because usually death comes after painful moments, after illnesses. We do not see death in any way different as a deeper awareness also of a full embodied lives. This is deeply, deeply related to how we address our bodies, how we handle our bodies, or how do we perceive our bodies, because interestingly, most of us deal with our bodies as living carcasses already, because we are not taking care of our bodies in a proper way. We say, well, we take care of it because we feed it, we bathe it, you know, but we do not really nourish our own bodies. We do not necessarily take the pleasure out of it. We do not tend to the body needs the way it is perhaps intended. We do not pay attention to its intricacies and to its sensations. And there is a certain estrangement between body and self. And I deal with a lot with college students. And perhaps for college students, that's the most noticeable part of their lives, in which they will stand in front of the mirror. Maybe you have had that same experience. I know, you know, I'm at an age in which I look at myself in the mirror and say, is that really me? Because the disconnect between who I am and who my body is so tangible in our Western Hemisphere that I do not feel a connection between who I think that I am and who I actually am. And the studies that are being made most recently in this country, especially among young adults, how much hatred towards their own bodies there actually is. That students will openly say, I hate my body. College students in this country, I mean, I'm coming from a sabbatical in which I've been doing a lot of research on embodiment, and the self-perception of young adults coming from eating disorders, anorexia and bulimia, cutting, involving in violent practices against their own bodies, which denotes a deep, deep hatred of their own body itself. And that, of course, is not aided at all by the media. If you turn on any TV program, and if it does not have violence against human bodies, then it's not a TV show. If you go to a movie and it does not have a car crashing or it does not have a person killed, then it is not a good movie. So we are used to the fact that violence against bodies is part of the way that we express ourselves. And because violence against bodies is such a form of entertainment, it is such a it's really taken for granted that that's you know, the norm, and it's not the exception. So I would like us to think about pain and embodiment also in a cultural setting. And I refer to, if you have this handout on When My Body Abandons Me, there is a paragraph, second page, which makes a very interesting analysis of how pain is addressed from the standpoint of different cultures. And let me just read for you a paragraph here. It says, drawing from the experiential aspect of pain, also culture plays an important role on how it is perceived and given meaning. For instance, Zabrowski's classic study, which came out in 1952, so this should be pretty much outdated, but people still refer to it, found different cultural responses to pain among Italian Americans, Jewish Americans, and Protestant old Americans, okay? Which would include Norwegians and Swedes. So the Italians emphasized the immediacy and actual sensation of pain, but quickly forgot their suffering once it was gone. The Jewish group was concerned with the significance of pain in relation to their health and welfare. I mean to say that there were future implications of their current pain. And the old Americans were less emotional and more detached in reporting pain, trying to avoid being a nuisance. So we, and I think in the field of medicine, there has been a lot of progress made also into understanding, you know, how cultures and individuals relate to pain. Now, illness in particular is also a reminder of human finite reality. It is, as people say, well, it's just an announcement that all of us are to die and nobody lives forever. And we see this ease as a lack of ease. There is something that is bothering me. As a manifestation of something that goes broader than just physical, because there are also emotional and there are also spiritual aspects to illnesses, to diseases. And when a person feels ill in our culture, in American society, she or he feels that their body has abandoned them, a sense that I can now no longer rely on it. And by even addressing the body as a it, you know, say now there is again a disconnect between who I am and who my body is. I want to go one place, but my body does not carry me there anymore. So I cannot really rely on my body. So my mind and my body are two different things. And an unreliable body leads to a sense of anguish and desperation as one looks for the reasons that lead to this situation. What should or what could be done to prevent illness, or what was wrong, what have I committed, how did I bring this upon me? And that is usually when somebody is feeling, is in a situation of pain or is diagnosed with some sort of illness. The first thing that we are taught in this culture is, because we are not only supposed to make ourselves, you know, kind of like pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps, but everything that happens to me is also caused by my own actions. And so I have brought this upon me. What I have done wrong to have caused this. And even I find myself in the same entrapment. Somebody tells me that she has some sort of physical limitation. And my immediate question, see, I'm so part of this mentality, saying, so what caused it? Did you do something to lead to that? As if there were some sort of remedy that if I just don't fall into that trap, then I can avoid that same type of condition. And I think it has a lot to do with, it has a positive motivation, because we talk about prevention, we talk about wellness. All the education we have been doing in terms of substance abuse and tobacco and alcohol and drugs. And so we are aware that, in fact, there is a cause-effect relationship. But there are some cases in which there just is no connection. And if our logic escapes that, oh, A caused B, therefore, you know, there is a reason for that disease, that lack of ease to exist. If something does not fall into that logic, then we have no explanation for it. And so we are left without any of the reasonable answers that we can address. And here is where I think a Lutheran theology can help us a little bit. So I would like you to turn to that second handout, which talks about, for God is also the God of bodies. One of the things that medieval times help us better understand the stigma that exists in relationship to pain is, even though we think that we have advanced significantly in the last five centuries in relationship to this causality, we are very close to medieval paradigms or medieval logic when it comes to you brought this upon yourself. Okay? And maybe it's a flawed theory, but correct me on it if you think it might be different. I'm always open for new ideas here. So in medieval times, the struggle for survival and the massive diseases that existed, the violence, the scarcity of food, the fact that a person was, that anybody could die at any point, that infant mortality, for instance, only one out of four children would survive, led to a very detached way in relationship to life as it was. Because everything that existed was so transitory, it's just so temporary anyway. So why should we bother after all? You only live, that's maybe maximum of 40, 50 years, you know, that would be perhaps a long and prosperous life if you manage to even achieve that age. If you brought up a number of children, then the survival of your family your traditions would continue. But in general, there was a detachment towards everything that related to everyday life or to how much to really invest in the quality of life. Now I'm talking about the average person. I'm not talking about, this is history from below. I'm not talking about the people who were the intellectuals. I'm not talking about people who were part of the bourgeoisie or people who were affluent in medieval society. I'm talking about your everyday folks here. And yet, the church in medieval times emphasize that certain body regimens mean to say if you were an ascetic, if you abstained from certain foods, from certain drinks, if you kept a feast, if you became celibate or an ascetic, then by denying the needs of the human body, you would elevate yourself. And this goes back to the early monastic, early ascetic movements in which monks would go out to the caves and proclaim from there that by living a life that was totally dedicated to prayer and contemplation, and by abstaining from everything that was down to earth or that indulged their sexual, physical appetites, that would put them closer to God. And that was pretty much a standard approach also in medieval days, and one very strongly emphasized also in Martin Luther's day, when he, for instance, decided to become a monk, because monks were seen as higher than the regular person, because that person being a monk, being celibate, abstaining from physical pleasures, was already closer to God than everybody else. And this type of mindset, as I said, very much influenced the way that theology was done in Martin Luther's day. And then you can see that also very clearly when Luther himself would describe the body in terms of a spirit, a soul, and a body. And I'm reading here from the handle the second paragraph and the quote that comes with it. He perceived the spirit as the highest, deepest, and noblest part of the human being, and the human body as its exterior manifestation. The soul gives life to the body and works through it. The body is not negative, although the flesh is sporadically referred to as a rotten old man. And the frequent admonishments to keep it under control. Here I'm quoting from his lectures on Romans. And the quote reads, "A living sacrifice is a body which is afflicted for the Lord. And it is called living sacrifice because it lives in virtues and it's dead to vices. It is a sacrifice because it is already dead to this world and its depraved works. Living because all the things it continues are good." Well, if somebody is living in a situation of pain, is suffering from an illness, if that person finds himself or herself in the midst of suffering, if they will read such a comment like the one that Luther makes in this, they would think that Luther is just in continuity with that medieval theology which diminished the role of the body and tried to keep it under control by elevating the soul as it is. And that's one of the problems that that we can incur when we just take sentences out of context. Because in the overall context of Luther's comment, that is just one side comment in the overall of his theology. So I give this here out of context because I want to show you also that we can read Luther in such a negative way. And one thing that it's necessary to do here then is going to a deeper level of Luther's reading and not just this superficial one or reading the text out of context. What happens with Luther is something very similar to, because Luther is an interpreter of Paul, and Luther is simply echoing a tension that you also find in the Apostle Paul when it comes to body. Well, those of you who are familiar with Greek, you know that there are two words that are constantly used here. And one word is sarx, and the other word is soma. So whenever the word sarx appears, it's translated in our English version as flesh. And sarx is supposed to be the flesh that can be corrupted, the flesh that can be deviated, something that might be prone to sin, that is very fallible. And then there is another use of the word, which is soma. And soma is usually translated as body. And body is used in a positive way. Every time it talks about the body of Christ, it refers to usually as soma. When it talks about the church as a body, it talks as soma. So you think, well, but this is very contradictory. Aren't they talking about the same thing? Right? Because at the end of the day, there is no distinction here between what is flesh and what's body, right? But what is behind this is a deep tension between a Greco-Roman philosophy and a Jewish approach to human body. Okay? And that's struggling. And Paul really struggles with this. Okay, and when he writes, for instance, in his letters, using Romans as one example, when he has to refer to the positive aspect of the body, because the body is a good creation, it was made by God, then he uses the word soma. But then he's also deeply influenced by the Greek and the Roman philosophical school, which has always seen the human body as something negative. How familiar are you with Greco-Roman philosophy? Not very much. Let me just give you one example of how this goes about. Plato, in the whole approach to embodiment. Maybe he summarizes best how in his philosophy, how negatively the material world, the body or the flesh or anything that connects us to the material reality, how negative it actually is. Plato uses the language that the body is a prison for our soul. And that prison needs to be kept under control, and the quicker we get rid of that prison, the quicker we get rid of our bodies, the quicker the soul or our spirit will go back to eternity, to the source from which it actually came. So the body is a carcass. The body does not have any meaning or purpose, but to imprison the spirit. And if that is the view that you have of the body, of course, you know, you will not take good care of it. There's really no point in cherishing it, because everything that the body is just an anchor or something that is like weighing at your foot and just, you know, dragging behind you, preventing you from being what would have been the original intention to light. Plato also had some interesting views of creation in some of his writings. He mentions that we were all part of we are all particles of light and these or spirit, and we want to go back to that source from which we came. And so after every life, every time we get rid of this carcass, we have an opportunity to then reincarnate. Of course, if I, as a woman, I'm a good woman, and I'm a good, I comply with what society tells me to, and then in my next incarnation, I can be a man, and then, you know, I can go back, you know, if I were a man, I can be, I'm a good citizen, I comply with what society expects from me, then when I die as a man, then I could go back to being that part of that light. But if I'm a woman and I'm too talkative, too opinionated, chances are I would die, and my carcass, you know, would get away. But then my spirit would incarnate in something that is below me, which would be an animal. And if I'm not a good animal, obedient, then I would eventually, my spirit would, you know, disappear, and I would turn into a stone. That's how Plato explained why there were so many rocks in Greece. that to explain to you the difference between Sartre and Soma. So Paul really struggles with this because he is educated in this Greek tradition. He is a scholar. He knows philosophy. He has to have that negative view, but he's also Jew. His mother and father probably told him, you know, in the Jewish tradition, we cherish bodies because we have to take good care of them, because bodies are part of a good creation. And Christians, we have inherited this. We have a very ambiguous, very complicated relationship with our bodies because of that, you know. You can always blame it on somebody else. can I have a volunteer to just read the two last paragraph on this page, for God is also the God of bodies, these two paragraphs on the bottom of the first page. Thank you.
On the surface, this might seem to imply that Christians should focus on spiritual rather than earthly bodily matters. However, Luther's theology offers a more integrated and holistic approach by focusing on qualities rather than on nature. The distinction is not between the body being bad and the spirit good. It is the use we make of these gifts that is at stake and defines them as good or evil. Thus, sexuality is not bad, but is part of God's good creation. Human sexuality is to be lived in ways that are healthy, respectful, mutually engaging, and caring. Even when Luther critiques bodily conduct, he insists that those who live chaste lives are no purer than others. In this world, we are bound by the needs of our bodily life, but we are not righteous because of them. That's Luther from Freedom of the Christian. Luther's notion of a Christian being saint and sinner, semiohistos et peccator,
is
relevant here. Nobody is better or worse than anybody else. Luther critiques the aesthetic, the monastic ideal. Is it not true that money, property, body, spouse, child, friends, and the like are good things created and given by God himself? In the mundane bodily realities of life, believers testify to their faith not by judging each other, but by caring for one another.
Okay, so what did Luther do with monastic vows? That would be a good example of how Luther perceives the human body. What did he do with monastic vows?
Eliminated
them. Mm-hmm. And do you know what the reasoning he gave for that was? I mean, he eventually got married to Katharina von Bora. Before him, many of the other reformers had gotten married. He was actually one of the last ones to get married, but eventually he did. But what was the argument? I mean, can you imagine what he would have argued for leaving the cloister and ceasing to be a monk and becoming a family man? What do you think he argued?
Is it a calling?
It's a calling. Very good. So you have been in other sessions? Indeed. Luther goes back to the notion of vocation. And he explains in other writings that human beings have a calling. And that vocation to be a priest is not different at all from the vocation to be a parent or a student or a farmer or a plumber. It is just a different type of calling. And all of us have multiple callings. Now, in Luther's theology, there is absolutely no hierarchy between the vocation of a priest, a monk, a pastor, and the vocation to be a mother. And he puts the same level of importance as it would be to teach at a college as it would be to change a baby's diapers. You know? Because all of that is part of how we serve God and our neighbor. So that's a very important argument that Luther used. What else?
Didn't Paul say if you can't survive without companionship, then you need to get married?
Okay, he actually put it in a little bit more spicy language. I appreciate your editing. And Luther said, well, not only is human sexuality something that needs to be kept under control, and in the Roman Catholic teachings of the 1500s, which is, you know, what Luther was exposed to, getting married was seen almost like a remedy for something that you cannot really address or cure. Okay, so if you cannot control it, you know, here you have it. And that really put monks or anybody who was a celibate above and beyond everybody else. And it plays into the notion of justification by good works. To be a celibate man was to do a good work, because I am doing something for my own salvation. I'm already putting myself above the average family person, because I can keep my sexual instincts, my desires under control. And by doing that, I have already, you know, piled up maybe 1,000 points in relationship to my own salvation. So if I want to reach heaven, I need to be, the more I am detached from everyday life, the closer I am to heaven. And that type of hierarchy very much permeates medieval theology. Now, some of you are probably already in your minds, you know, I see some gears going very quick. You say, 21st century. You find some people who might have similar mentality. You know, the quicker we go through this, you know, the quicker we'll get to the afterlife. Thinking about rapture, I'm thinking, so it's not something that is totally outlandish to our own context here, right? Okay, excellent. That's a good way of putting it. Jerome, one of the early church fathers, he said that in terms of a value, he would give virginity, means to become be ascetic, to be a monk, he would give a value of 100, because that would put you closer to heaven. Widowhood, he would put a level, give a 50, maybe, because that meant you had already some detachment and you were already looking for your afterlife. But to marriage, he would give a 0, because marriage did not fill heaven, it only filled the earth. So the value of marriage in and of itself was considered null. The real point of achieving salvation was to deny everything that had to do with the human body. Okay, so excellent. Any other ideas?
How would somebody like that understand the metaphor of Christ and the church as a married couple or husband and wife?
Right. And those of you who are experts in Lutheran theology will understand why Luther was so categorical against the allegorical interpretation of Scripture, because everything in the Bible that referred to husband and wife language was never seen as the latter itself. You know, that was never seen literally. It was always interpreted as an allegory for something else. So it really had, so for instance, one of the most central books that we have in the Bible, the Songs of Solomon, they were not seen as showing intimacy between a man and a woman, and how we had a book in the Bible that never had the name of God in it, and yet it reflected divine love as carried out between human beings. That was never perceived as a celebration of human sexuality, because you know, the reading of it was always, well, it's supposed to symbolize something else. It's supposed to symbolize the relationship between Christ and the church, between Israel and God, between God's people and Creator. So Luther, going back to, want to say, here we have to go back to what the text actually says, shifts around and challenges this allegorical mode of interpretation. But at the end of the day, the key reason for Luther to abolish monasticism was to say, not only is it wrong that we are putting, you know, people who abstain from getting married or from engaging or falling in love with other people as sinful, that, you know, who doesn't do that is then perceived as high off, or that sexual intercourse or marriage is then used as a remedy to alleviate that. But Luther goes back, especially in the commentary to Genesis, he finds very positive use of human sexuality. And he says, God has created this for us. God has created our bodies for our own benefit, because God takes delight in our bodies, and we are supposed to take delight in our bodies as well. And he finds this also very poetic, in a very poetic manner. There's a quote quote, which I would like somebody to read, which is just in continuity with the text that was just read. It's a quote from Sermons of the Gospel of John. Can somebody read that? It's a very fine print. But would fit the last minute. Thank you so much. Yeah.
To be sure, he, Jesus, did depart from them, his disciples, physically, so he is no longer visible, but he left his peace behind to all Christendom. Where? Nowhere else than in his baptism, in the sacrament, and in the office of the ministry. I will say nothing of the other gifts and goods, also the physical ones, which he bestows on us, such as father and mother, government, order, temporal peace, and the like. How angry can God really be if he lets his sun rise for us every day, if he gives us good weather, if he lets all kinds of plants, fruits, and nourishments grow for us, if he favors us with healthy bodies and members? If we could look at these things properly, we would have to say, he surely has given us great treasures, above all, peace and joy toward him, and, in addition, all kinds of physical benefactions on earth, visible and palpable evidence of his mercy and his willingness to help us. Therefore, we should learn not to be afraid or faint-hearted before him. He does not want to do us harm, otherwise he would not have given us his word, baptism, and sacrament.
I chose this quote because I think it takes such irreverence to be able to talk about everyday things, fruits from a tree, plants, our own bodies, everything that goes on with our bodies, and talk about sacraments at the same time. And the paragraph starts with sacraments, talks about everyday life and the sacredness in life and how God is so good because God has given us all these things, and it goes back to the language of sacraments again. One of the most beautiful ways that Luther explains the gift of this is perhaps in his explanation in the Catechism, in which he talks about how God really provides and how God nourishes us every day. And what we can do is to only say thank you, I mean, and enjoy it, and we cannot do much more than that. Now, the whole creation, in fact, provides us with an opportunity to encounter God. And in honor of his songs, for instance, Luther would say, if I see the beauty of creation, if I see the beauty of everything that God has made and how God has provided for us, I cannot help but fall on my knees and praise God. And that's the type of, you know, living a life of gratitude is to acknowledge that, in fact, everybody else is equally created as well and is also a gift from God. I want to read a short quote from the lectures on Genesis, and this is actually my favorite quote. All good things then must be traced back to God because they are gifts of God put into practice, not only in the spirit, but also outside and toward people. Okay? Our gifts are put also into practice outside and toward people. For God is also the God of bodies. Isn't this a beautiful statement? For God is also the God of bodies. Therefore, he provides us with bodily gifts, and he wants us to enjoy these gifts with gladness. So, it's very good when we can celebrate healthy bodies, because God is also the God of bodies. But how do we then deal with bodies who are in dis-ease? Bodies who have a lack of ease, who do not necessarily fall into the conformity of, you know, that machine. And here is where God is also a God of bodies, because God is also a body of vulnerability. So we do not need to change our notion of God being a God of bodies, but our notion of what a body really is, of who we really are as embodied human beings. Can somebody read the next two paragraphs that follow this, the one started with yet?
Sure. Yet these are not entitlements to be taken for granted. God is not obligated to provide them to us. They are gifts. To squander, lose a sense of awe, commodify or objectify the material world is sinful. As Luther explains the petition in the Lord's Prayer, "Give us today our daily bread." When material things become the center of our concerns, then mammon rules and not God. Yet God creates and sustains us. Life is a gift, and is as is the whole creation. Luther's theology allows us to see creation itself as a manifestation of divine grace, which we are invited to partake and share with one another. Our bodies and our sexuality are God's gifts to us, in which we are to take delight. For Luther, God's creation of the material world is to be enjoyed. These gifts seem secular and profane. A Stoic or a Pharisee would ask whether they are lawful. People of this kind are exceedingly disgusting. They allow the body to know the light and enjoy it all. It is their religion which Paul describes in Colossians 2:23, namely, not to spare the body, but to torture and kill it until it is reduced to nothing. Thus it is said of Bernard that in order to overcome his lust, he tormented his body to such an extent that eventually the brothers could not associate with him because of his stinking breath. God created body and soul, and he wants recreation allowed to both, but in a definite amount and manner.
One of the things in which we can really see how God is a God of bodies is the incredible capacity that human bodies have in recovery. Even though we might deal with illness with disease, the body itself regenerates and is always recreating. If you have ever felt sick, if you had a flu, if you have a virus, when you start to think about it, when you come out of it, you should really exclaim that you believe in the resurrection of the body. Because that is what happens every day. You know, when you sleep, you come out of it, your body is just resurrected. And in fact, you are so renewed with your energy. And that is, if you come to think about our body itself, it's like God speaks to us in our, if we pay attention to our bodies in a very deep and spiritual manner. That whatever happens to us are also ways that we can better understand God through our embodied selves. And coming out of, both Pat and I were ill earlier this week, and we said, yeah, we do believe in the resurrection of bodies because we can't stand here enough. And it didn't seem like that earlier this week. But the wisdom also in the body. The fact that God has given us two ears and only one mouth. I think it's a fantastic thing that we are supposed to listen twice and speak only once, right? Because to be attentive, to care for others. And, you know, God has taught us some really wonderful things. if we pay attention to them, I think we can also learn the resilience that comes with embodiment and how God's hope is manifested in the very awareness that the body constantly, our bodies, they deteriorate, but they also regenerate, they renovate themselves. So if we pay attention to this, I think we also might have a deeper sense of our own spirituality. One thing that for me is very visible. We have been talking about self-centeredness, the reality of you know, what does it mean to be a good Christian. And I was packing when I left from Brazil to come to the U.S. I was actually shocked by how much stuff, you know, I had accumulated in 14 years living in Brazil. It's like, I have no idea I had so much stuff. And and coming to terms with how easy, you know, how our bodies really we give ourselves away. If you do this movement, you know, it seems so easy, you know, to gather, to collect, you know, to accumulate. This is easy. You can do this 100 times. You will not be tired. Now try the opposite, to give. It's like, ooh, after 10 times, it already hurts, you know? And then, you know, it's really built in us how we have to rethink even the way that our posture, you know, we give ourselves away here. Does anybody want to read the last sentence, the last paragraph here? One that's very much geared towards hope. Thank you.
Pain experience can be described.
No, the body is a beautiful.
I'm sorry.
Out of hand. Thank you.
The body is a beautiful and noble creature of God. Therefore, it is also our responsibility to assure the well-being of other people's bodies. We cannot save their souls. Salvation is God's prerogative alone. But we can and must work for the good of each other's bodies and all that that might entail. This is the whole realm of Christian action. Doing good works for the sake of the good of others, not merely for our own good.
So a big question that I have personally had in the past years, and it has to do with all the work that I've been doing in Brazil, within the Amazon area, or in Christian-based communities. If Christianity had really embraced a theology of incarnation, that the Word becomes flesh to live in our midst, that God is in your body, God is in you, and whenever I encounter another human being, an embodied self, that it's also an encounter with God, the history of the church would be very different. And if we had not adopted this Platonic negative view of the body and focus so much on the salvation of the soul, our history would be very different. And if we had said that the aim of Christianity was not to save souls, because that's God's prerogative, but to save bodies, I think we would have a very different reality in the world these days. These are some of the things that puzzle me. So how can we go back into affirming the goodness of bodies and affirming also that bodies in pain are a big locus for our mission as church? So that's some of the things that I'm concerned with these days. I know that just from my days here at the village, that each of you has an incredible, and some of you I've had the chance to engage in conversation with, and I know that all of you are involved in outstanding ministries. If you want to take some time to share with this that you are doing, we would still have a few minutes, or if you have some questions or comments that you want to get out there. I'm always available for conversations. Yes, Rita.
Vanda, I'm curious if you could respond. I noticed earlier you talked about cutting and addiction and the ways that people treat their bodies, and I work particularly with incarcerated youth, and I work in the 12-step program, and when I meet with especially young girls, I mean, they just have cut marks all up and down their arms, and the pain that they've gone through in their lives and the things that they're addicted to. And I find that a lot of it is to forget or not really deal with what they need to deal with.
Right.
And so from an embodied theology, do you have any wisdom about working with these young people or scripture, or where we can turn to give hope?
The resources come not only from theology, but they need to be very interdisciplinary. First, from gender studies, we know that boys and girls enact violence in a different way. Girls always practice violence against themselves and their bodies. So young women will engage, that is the rule. I mean, there are exceptions, of course. There are young men who also have eating disorders, but young women will usually hurt themselves. Because they are hurt, they will carry out violence against their bodies. Hence the cutting, the eating issues, etc. Boys, on the other hand, will carry out violence against others and engage in activities that will harm others. The majority of youth involved in gangs, for instance, will be men, not necessarily women. Of course, there are some variations there too. The help that we have had, especially if you dealing with issues of pastoral counseling, all that we have learned in terms of healing and being able to voice their own life experiences, usually it's not something that just comes out of nothing. And just being able to tap into what are the sources, where is this memory coming from? My notion of embodiment, the way I work with, is one that draws from thinkers like Michel Foucault, in which he says the human body is a surface that inscribes my history. This is a surface. This is a text. I'm a living text. And every mark I have is something that has happened to me. And so their own wounds are signifiers of events that have happened in their life. Being able to name them can then help you in, naming is very important, but then also in the healing process. But it's not a quick fix it. I know we want to have, and that's also how we address human pain. Our society is the anesthesia. We just want quick fix. I have a headache. I need something for it now. There is pain. I just want to be numb to it. And that is the same approach we have to everything. So some pains cannot be addressed just by taking aspirin or ibuprofen. Yes.
I was going to say, isn't that done a lot because they don't feel, or they don't feel alive? I mean, pain at least makes you feel alive.
No, they are very much alive. There is so much hurt. It's overwhelming. And the physical pain is just something that allows to concentrate on a localized pain. This is pain to just one part of my body. And then I can just concentrate on what is happening right there and then, as opposed to what is happening all over my body. I think we tend to believe that pain, this is a very Cartesian notion of pain. Pain happens in one part of the body and then it's communicated to the brain and the brain has to process it, but it's very localized. And my daughter, she just explained that to me one day when she had her first heartbreak. Her friend did something to her that really hurt her, and she said, she was telling me what had happened, and I, not really paying a lot of attention, and I said, well, it really makes your heart hurt, doesn't it? And she looked at me and she said, no, my whole body is hurting. And that notion of pain as an all-encompassing experience was quite a revelation to me. And it took a five-year-old to tell me, my adult perception of just localizing, compartmentalizing. And in that case, people, and I know, I've talked to some of you who do hospice work, people who have work with terminally ill people in that type of care, and you know what that experience is all about. It's not just one thing. It's the whole of existence. Yes.
Well, I think there's a huge social issue that we tend to ignore. I'm a mother, an older mother of a 7-year-old, and I think the whole Barbie culture is enormous, puts enormous pressure on women, on female gender, and the pain that is created from not having a perfect body for a child just continues to build, I think, throughout our lives.
I would like to invite you to come to the session tomorrow. I'm really going to talk about embodied theology tomorrow. So if you could come back and share your views about that, that would be fantastic. Could you come?
Tomorrow.
Oh, no. Okay. Yes.
Just to comment a little bit about how can we be more in tune with people in pain. I'm a hospital chaplain. And my experience is that people in pain or would rather believe that they've done something wrong than there is no reason. There is no, that it's a mystery. While some people are ill and some aren't, while someone is in an accident and who isn't. And I think that also plays into, I think all of us, when we encounter someone, there's fear. There's fear that if it can happen to them. I mean, it's a reminder of how finite we are and how things can happen and that they are difficult. Yes. And the one area I see the most fear is mental illness. I've worked with people in mental illness units. And I would include mental illness as part, you know, the mind is part of the body, certainly. And that there's such fear of people with mental illness. And I think that's a particular group of people that certainly could use some love and care and support and understanding.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yes?
I talked to my aunt about this after Bible study the other day, but I couldn't help but bring it up when we were talking about the body and Lamentations, not necessarily this morning, but the previous morning. Everything that they talked about in there was physical suffering. So it is everywhere, and it is recognized how severe the physical suffering was in the first book of Lamentation. Everything was in your bones, the aching in your bones, and everything in there was a physical, almost more than the emotional pain of the suffering.
And one of the things that our culture, Western culture, has done so well is to hide pain. We trivialize pain. First, we hospitalize it. We institutionalize it. We segregate people who are in pain because then they are away from our eyesight. And the issue of lamentation, look, you know, there's no way that you can avoid my sight, you know. But we have been skillfully removed that, and we do not want to do that. But then also in our everyday reality, you know, we are deeply annoyed by other people sharing their pain experiences with us. And why we are annoyed? Because it reminds us of our own finite reality. I don't want to hear about it. You know, I have no patience. So even the formality of how are you in this country, this is a taboo question. You're never supposed to ask how are you, you know, but we just pretend that we can carry on with life. But that is very much part of who we are, because we are supposed to be okay. We're supposed to always be smiling. And then pain is, or suffering or violence are perceived as, you know, secondary. We have control over them because we can joke about it, we can be entertained by it, we laugh at it, very much like the Bowman Circus, we laugh at it, because that's what our media is all about, you know.